Ladies and gentlemen, the Vice President of the United States, Hubert Humphrey.
Thank you very much, Governor Dempsey. I have so many things that I want to say to each and every one of you tonight that I'm afraid we may be in for quite a long evening, so lean back. Just relax. The Right Reverend Monsignor LaFontaine and Rabbi Feldman, and of course, Governor John and Mary Dempsey, and Senator Tom and Grace Dodd, and my very good friend here, your national chairman of the Democratic Party, and his lovely lady, Mrs. Bailey. You know, I want to say that when John Bailey got up here to say that he was introducing his boss, this is the first time I've ever caught him lying red-handed. What a wonderful, wonderful, friendly gathering. I told Senator Ribicoff, my friend Abe, on the way up here, that I knew this was going to be a pleasant evening. I said, Abe, you know, you good people from Connecticut, you just giving you sort of commute. You shouldn't have to go back and forth like this. Well, he said, I have two reasons I want to go, Hubert. He was very kind. He said, first, because you're going to be there. And he said, secondly, he said, I always remember a story that you told me once. You told me the story about when you used to leave the Senate back in those years of 1953, 54, every weekend and go back home to Minnesota. And as you'd go out that back door, there'd be one senator there every time and say, are you going home again, Hubert? He said, there's no need of it. You're going to win. Our polls are the same. I have the same percentage that you have. And jokingly, but it turned out to be prophetic, I said, yes, I'm going to go home again because I like to be here again. The other man didn't get back. And my friend, Senator Ribicoff, reminded me of that. There's a little lesson in it. Then I noticed that you have your whole congressional delegation here tonight, with the exception of Mim Daddario, who's out looking over those capsules, John, that you were going to be sent in. Congressman Daddario is on the Space Committee, and he's keenly interested in the developments, of course, of our space and aeronautical science, which means so much to your state. But we have all the rest of them here, and I want my good friend Bob Gimo to know that I'm not going to forget him tonight. When I was in New Haven battling it out with those Yale students, Arthur, I forgot Bob there. But I want you to know, Arthur, I'll never forget you. I'll never forget you. And what a wonderful town chairman and what a wonderful banquet chairman to have a fellow like Art Barbieri here with us this evening. The only thing I can't understand, Arthur, is how come you, with a good Italian name like that, didn't have your first name Horatio and my middle name Arthur. Well, I'll get around to that, too. I noticed that there are many notables here. We have your, as I said, your whole delegation, and I'm a baseball fan. And one of the great baseball heroes of the New York Yankees years ago was the second baseman. His name was Grabowski. And I see that Bernard's here. He pitches a fastball and catches one once in a while. It's sure nice to have him. And Don Irwin and my good friend that Came up in the plane with us tonight, John Monaghan. John's the kind of a fellow, he called me up and he said, going to Connecticut? I said, yes. He says, have black tie, we'll travel, Hubert. And we made that trip together here today. And Bill St. Ange is with us. The whole delegation. Of course, I went down to see Bee here a moment ago and said that she had me all shook up. It's already been mentioned here. But I don't want your wonderful National Committee woman ever again to come to one of these banquets unless Bee Rosenthal has on one of those big hats, not that little one that you're wearing like tonight, Bee. I signed her program tonight. I said, Queen of Democrats and Hats. She went right upstairs and changed hats right after that. Well, I got to answer a question this evening before we go one step further. It's a question that's been raised here by several. And I quote it, put it down. What did Hubert Humphrey say to Tom Dodd when they took that plane ride to Washington? Are you newspaper boys ready? I don't want to be unfair. I don't want any misquotations. I want you to get your pencils out now because I'm going to let you in on the secret. I saw him at the airport. Our friendship was coming to a fast end. Then I decided that was no way to act, and so I took an entirely different tack. I became compassionate and considerate. And I walked up to him, I put my hands on his shoulders with a tear in my eye. I said, Tom, listen to me, dear friend. Tom, this plane isn't safe. It's all a fact. Tom said, I care not, I'm a brave man. This man was really testing me. Then I remembered that phrase in those war years, and I said, Tom, my friend, think this over. Is this trip really necessary? Then I knew I had him because I remembered that this was the year of his challenge for re-election. And I said, Tom, and I looked him right in the eye. I really had him. I just right in on him. I said, Tom, Connecticut needs you. But now that this fellow has won the smashing victory and he's had the greatest majority that anyone ever received in the history of this state, I want you to know that even though I pressed that point of his being needed here, he shrugged it off. Oh, yes. I wouldn't tell on him during the campaign, but now the truth is out. So we got down to Washington. We drove up to the White House. And the president invited in first, mind you. Not me. Oh, no. Again, always a bridegroom, never a bride. And I looked at Tom, and just as he went out, I grabbed him by the hand and held him for just a moment, and I said, Tom, if he asks you, be brave, say no. Colonel Blake, when you get ready to do something for this fellow tonight, you just remember what kind of a fellow this is. He was a brave man. A very brave man. Well, what a wonderful experience it is to be here once again with all of you, and I truly like it. You know, that's the devastating part of my whole life. I just sort of like what I'm doing all the time. And I'm delighted, too, that you've had the privilege tonight of seeing this wonderful, fine son of a truly great American. a father by the name of Gene Tunney, and a son that honors the name by the name of John Tunney. He's going to be a fine congressman, and boy, are we proud of him and proud to have him here tonight. Well, I came up here to, not just to praise Tom Dodd, because Tom, you've got it made. You don't need any praise. But I did come here to talk about our party and talk about our country, talk about the world in which we live. I come here because this state has given so much to us all, one of the great states of the Union. My forebears are from this state and the state of Massachusetts. My great-grandfather moved from this very state to Union Lakes, Minnesota in 1848. There are many a Humphrey buried in the cemeteries of the state of Connecticut. But I come here because you have given so much to America. You've given her freedom. You've given her great scientists, great men of the arts and letters. You've given her great, great public figures. And in most recent years, you've given us our national chairman. I've mentioned him before. I just can't tell you how good it is to be with him. And I can't tell you how good it is to have him with me. I can remember once or twice when he was with me as a social being, but not politically. And I love him. I really do. He's a fine and wonderful man. And I come here tonight because while we honor this distinguished senior senator of yours, my friend, and he is, and for many years, and he is the friend of our president, and the president of the United States is the friend, and everybody knows it, of Tom Dodd. But I know that my good friend, your senior senator, Tom Dodd, would want me to say that another good reason for being here tonight is to call to your attention, and if possible, by word and deed, to pay honor to a great governor. I can say, having traveled throughout this nation in every state, that I know of no state that has had finer leadership, more progressive leadership, more responsible leadership, a better chief executive than the state of Connecticut. And if this state doesn't do right by John Dempsey, then I think it's lost its good judgment, but I think it will. Governor Dempsey, I do want you to know how appreciative both Muriel and I are of your kind invitation to be with you and your lovely wife, and how much we hope and pray that your leadership may be continued in this Commonwealth. And if the time ever comes where you think I can be of any help by either praising you or condemning you, but I mean it sincerely, if I can ever be of any help to you in any way, I will consider it an opportunity and a privilege. Well, of course, John Bailey knows what you're in for. You know, since I became vice president, I generally have to prepare some remarks. But I haven't quite gotten used to being vice president yet, so I come with a vice president speech and I come with a Humphrey speech. You have to get a little of both. But I want to just say once again that this state, in all of its many endeavors, in all of its activities and its problems, truly represents what we're trying to do and the problems that we face in the achievement of what our president calls the Great Society. Remember, you had an awful lot to do with getting this program that is now before the Congress. You had a lot to do with getting it initiated. Yours was the first state to have its full returns in on that election night. It was your state and your voters, your electorate, that electrified the nation with this smashing majority. And you sent the signal like an electrical impulse throughout the land to tell us that a new day had dawned. So I think of all the places to discuss what we call the Great Society, it's right here in Hartford, Connecticut, the capital of the state. I think this is the right time and the right place to do it. You here, you know the pressing needs of your cities. As your own mayor, Glenn, has said here tonight, this is, in a very real sense, the America of the future. The America that people talk about is here, right here in your state. Because, my dear friends, by the year 1980, 85 out of every 100 Americans are going to be living in cities. And the state of Connecticut is a part of what we call this great seaboard, this great metropolitan area, megalopolis they call it, all the way from Boston to Norfolk, one great complex of city, suburb, community, continuous. And every problem that this America is going to face, every one that these young congressmen will face 15 years from now, is here right in your state now. So we have an opportunity to go to work, not in a theoretical sense, but in a very true sense on these problems. You know the pressing needs of your cities. You know the need for better transit and transportation. And ladies and gentlemen, let me give you a figure that'll shake you up. By the year 1970, there will be 90 million automobiles on the streets and roads of America. 90 million, 5 years from now. Isn't it amazing that a country that tries to find ways of interplanetary travel, ways to get a man on the moon, has been so slow and so reluctant and so backward in finding out how we can move mankind from Hartford to New York to Washington or to Philadelphia? It seems to me we ought to be able to do something about that. So this man, Tom Dodd, that's been working on the railroad, I'll say he has. And as I will note to you tonight, he's not only been working on it, he's getting it done. Here's a place where you know of your great heritage, the history of our country. You're concerned about natural beauty. You've done a great deal in this state, Governor, I know, coming from the great Midwest with our Superior National Forest, our Chippewa National Forest. I know of the reforestation program that took place here in Connecticut and continues even to this day. Your concern over polluted rivers. Your concern over the conservation of natural resources. And my fellow Americans, we better take care of these resources. We're going to have to live here, and our children are going to have to live here, and no generation has the right to destroy that which God gives. None. And I think you know the problems of the elder citizen, the need for better housing and better medical and hospital care. And I think you know the needs and the demands of our youth. By 1970, 50% of the entire population of America under age 25. 5 years from now, 21 to 22 million Americans age 65 and older. The youth on the one hand, 50% of the population, the elderly on the other hand, representing over 10% of the population. Is it any wonder, therefore, that we have to come to grips with these problems now? And this is what I like about your delegation in Congress. This is what I like about your governor. They're not worshiping some distant past. They're looking ahead in transportation and education, looking ahead to conserve resources, rebuild cities, making our cities some place in which to live and not just a place in which to work. And here you know about the problems and the challenges for better school facilities and better teaching. You know a little bit about unemployment too, and also of unequal opportunity. But I repeat, what you know best of all is that we can do something about them. I spoke to a group of about 800 young people last night, the returnees from the Peace Corps. Over 3,000 young Americans have been in 46 countries doing a job for America, for humanity. And they're popular, they're respected. There were some 800 or 900 of them in the State Department auditorium last evening, and a few of them had expressed themselves about their frustrations, their problems of readjustment. And I said, don't talk about frustrations and readjustment. Look at me. I mean, have you ever heard about being a senator and then becoming vice president? There are many frustrations for all of us, many readjustments. But this is the most exciting period in which to live that any generation has ever known. This is the best period in which to live. There never were any good old days. Not nearly as good as these days. Of course we've got problems. Of course we face dangers. There's never been a time that humanity didn't face dangers. There's never been a time that we didn't have problems. But what do we have besides problems and dangers? We have the know-how. We have the experience. We have the knowledge. We have the resources. We have the tools for the first time in history to do something about these problems. We no longer ever need to face the specter of famine in this world. We have the means to prevent it. We know how to raise the food. When I say we, I mean humanity knows how to raise the food for the first time to feed God's children. We have made breakthroughs in the conquest of disease that literally make the miracles of the scriptures seem like an everyday story. I can't help but remember one of those great lines in scriptures, the greater things that I have done, ye shall do also. And every day we heal the sick. Every day we see to it that the blind see. Every day we see to it that those who are crippled walk again. We perform miracles through modern medicine and modern science. We'll conquer the space, the cosmos. We'll know more about it. We will travel to the moon. Surely we'll be there. We will know more about interplanetary travel. What an amazing, exciting period in which to live. And your government is in it, and you're in it. We have a partnership. We're doing something about it. And I'm telling you, my good friends, that it takes a political party and it takes leadership of a political party that looks to the future to come to grips with this kind of an exciting challenge. You know, we have these problems on Earth as well as these challenges beyond Earth. We have problems at home as well as those overseas. And I don't mean that we must treat one to the exclusion of the other. I don't think you can ignore the world in which we live because it's getting to be a smaller neighborhood all the time. And I don't think you can ignore the conquest of space because either we move into space and learn about it and make it a laboratory for peace, or someone else is going to move into it and make it a battlefield for war. I don't think we can ignore anything, but there are things to do at home as well as abroad. A great 17th century poet once said that great cities seldom rest. Mayor, you know that. Governor, you know that. The restlessness of a city, its energy, its dynamism, either for good or for evil. And that poet went on to say that if there be none to invade from afar, they will find worse foes at home. This is another way of saying that our immediate danger is not only from afar, but there are some dangers here at home. And we know who those foes are today. We can identify the enemy, the international enemy of communism and totalitarianism and dictatorship, the international enemy of hopelessness and frustration and poverty, but also the domestic enemies. They're here in Connecticut, and they're in Minnesota, and New York, and Pennsylvania, and Massachusetts, and Rhode Island, and every state that you can think of. What are they? They are slums, crime, a lack of playgrounds and recreational area and parks, overburdened schools, inadequate transportation, the crowding, the lack of clean air. These are just some of the enemies. And one of the reasons that I come here tonight to honor this great senator of yours is that he saw those enemies long ago. He was one of the first, for example, to advocate a special little division in the Justice Department for civil rights. He's been the leader in the United States Senate to try to do something about this rising tide of delinquency. He has been able to see the necessity for better cities and better life. And when you find one in your midst that has some vision, honor him while he is yet with you. Encourage him, not only by your votes, but by your love and by your respect and by your affection. And you're doing that tonight. Yes, Tom and Governor, these great cities are growing. Hartford's growing. Bridgeport's growing. New Haven's growing. Minneapolis is growing, cities and suburbs. Each year in the coming generation, for the next 20 years, each year, we will add the equivalent of 15 cities the size of Hartford to our urban population every single year. We got something to do. If we didn't do anything else but put in the water lines and the sewage lines and the streets and the parks, but with cities comes something else. Now, President Johnson comes from a country town in Texas. And Hubert Humphrey comes and grew up in a country town in Dakota, South Dakota. A little later on, President Johnson had the opportunity to become a teacher and an NYA administrator, National Youth Administration. And if I recall correctly, Tom, you too were an NYA administrator. You know, it could have been that we'd had these two NYA boys taking over everything if it hadn't have been for me. But isn't this a story about America? Here is a great president whose first job was a teacher in a little country school. Most of his students were Mexican-Americans, impoverished. This teacher gave his first paycheck of $65 to the students so they could buy playground equipment and books. His vice president was born in a town of less than 100, grew up in a little community of less than 600. The president of the United States went from his little village to the Congress as a secretary and a clerk. I went from my little town to a slightly larger town in South Dakota where I got my first break, married Muriel. And from there we went to a larger city, Minneapolis. And after a very few years, it was my privilege to be mayor of that city. And after a very few years, it was Lyndon Johnson's privilege to be congressman from his district. And here today, the President of the United States, this boy from the country, has proposed the most far-reaching program, the most significant program for cities, for an urbanized, industrialized America that any president has ever proposed in the history of this nation. And it means a better life for millions and millions of people. Not at the exclusion of rural America, not at the expense of someone else, but building, creating for more and more Americans a better life. Last week, the president proposed a program to establish a Department of Housing and Urban Development. We need it. We've got a Department of Agriculture. We have a Department of Labor. We have a Department of Commerce. It seems to me that it's about time we grew up and that we started to synthesize, to bring together all of the creative and constructive forces of this country to see to it that our cities and our urban areas had proper representation and consideration. Now, I mentioned your mass transit problem, your mass transportation problem. We're not kidding about this anymore. This is out of the academic stage. President Johnson has committed this administration, Governor, and Mayor, and Senators, and Congressmen. He has committed this administration, first of all, to the technical research that is needed, and secondly, to the development of high-speed, intercity surface transport. And he has suggested that we begin by demonstrating possible improvements in rail passenger services between Washington and Boston into this Northeast corridor. And if you'll bestir yourself and make yourself heard, and let your voice not only be heard in Connecticut, but across this land, we can make that achievement, and you can have a little more time with your family and less time bumper to bumper on the highways. I must say that I sympathize with folks that have to spend an hour to 2 hours a day, 3 hours a day some, trying to get to an 8 hour a day job. It just doesn't make sense. It takes longer, my dear friends, to get from the Pentagon in Washington to the Capitol than it does from Washington, D.C. to Detroit. It isn't right. Something ought to be done about that. Well, now, there's something else that we want to do. I mentioned it a moment ago, and I'm citing these programs. There isn't any more beautiful part of America than this country of Western Connecticut and Massachusetts. I've been there. Beautiful, rolling hills, lovely countryside. Let's keep it that way. Now, this can be, however, paradise lost. Clean water and air can be and are being polluted. Automobile junkyards can crowd in on our highways. Our cities can and are losing precious open space. Our landmarks can be and are being destroyed. In some parts of this country, these things are already in the past tense. They have long since happened, and nature will be mighty hard indeed to reclaim. But this administration, the one you elected, has a program that is before the Congress now to set into motion the forces required to preserve our natural beauty, to lend some real meaning to the great society. The great society, my dear friends, isn't just a bigger bank account, and it isn't just more production of goods and services. And the great society isn't just gross national product. And it isn't just the finance page, as important as those things are. And this administration surely is dedicated to an expanding and growing economy through our private enterprise system.